This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beats here on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell with you here on this Tuesday morning. There's been a lot of discussion around the fact that Fiji is going to be opening up very, very soon to tourists. But what about other countries around the Pacific?
We really need to get the vaccination coverage rate into the 80s and especially into the 90s before we can feel a bit safer and said maybe Vanuatu is now, you know, not only, you know, COVID-free but COVID-safe.
First up here on the show, you're going to hear from Vanuatu, Samoa and other countries all about what their plans are. And then coming up a little bit later on in the show, I'm going to be joined by the Executive Director of the Tonga Ladies Association. He's going to be joining me to chat about how the Pacific's LGBTQI community is still healing from the death of Polly Kefu. The human rights activist was killed back in April. And the man who killed him has been jailed for life. He's going to join me in about 40 minutes' time to chat. And also coming up in about 10 minutes' time, it's a love story for the ages. After spending about 551 days apart, an Australian woman and her Solomon Islands partner have been reunited after borders around the world shut down.
It was just the endlessness of it that was really difficult. And then we saw each other and it was just like I could breathe.
Stephanie Wheeler's beautiful story coming up in about 10 minutes. But first, as Australians look forward to international borders reopening, demand for travel to the Pacific is heating up. But while Fiji prepares to welcome tourists back in December, other Pacific countries aren't rushing to follow suit. As Marion Farr reports, despite the economic impact of keeping borders closed, they're taking a more cautious approach.
With pristine beaches and tropical weather, Samoa is a holidaymaker's paradise. But the Pacific country is still off limits to international visitors.
In the past 2 years, Samoa has perhaps shown the most cautious approach.
When COVID-19 broke out in March last year, Samoa closed its borders to the rest of the world. While its economy has struggled without tourism, the government isn't taking any risks when it comes to opening up.
For obvious reasons, they had the measles outbreak at the end of 2019, which was absolutely devastating for their country.
Dr. Regina Skevens is a Pacific tourism and development expert from Massey University. She's been looking at the impact of COVID-19 on tourism in the region.
I think there's definitely enthusiasm from a number of Pacific governments to get their economies boosted again by return to tourism. But they've done a very good job in many cases of protecting their own populations. So for them, they don't want to risk their population's health.
Fiji recently announced it'll open borders to fully vaccinated tourists from a select group of countries in December. The news has seen thousands of Australians rush to book holidays to the country, which has now fully vaccinated more than 80% of its citizens. But other island nations aren't rushing to follow suit. In Samoa, the focus is still on vaccinating as many people as possible. The country recently completed a 2-day campaign, going door to door and offering people the jab. More than 90% of adults have now had one dose. But CEO of the Samoa Tourism Authority, Fa'amatu'ainu Lenata'i Suifua, says it's not until that same number are fully vaccinated that discussions about reopening can begin.
As much as we want the borders to open, it's the priority now for the government, as well as us over here, is that ensuring that the population is safe and well secure before we actually look into discussions again.
While some people might be hoping to get to Samoa in time for Christmas, they might have to wait until early next year. And when the country does start to welcome visitors back, people in New Zealand are likely to be first in line.
So we have a really, really quite high number of Samoans living in New Zealand. They've been missing home for the last 2 years, and we know that that is one of Samoa's key markets.
In Vanuatu, it could be an even longer wait to reopen. While some cruise companies are taking bookings to the Pacific destination for May next year, Director of Public Health Len Taravonda says July is a more realistic goal.
Perhaps not, the borders flung totally wide open, but at least to start to ease the restrictions.
Right now, just 17% of adults in Vanuatu have been fully vaccinated. And Mr. Taravonda says the country's health system couldn't cope with an outbreak of the virus.
And we're worried that, you know, of course, if only a few cases, even those few cases might even start to overwhelm the system.
If that does happen, Vanuatu will rely on the international community for help.
At the moment, as part of our plan, we are already trying to also indicate to our development partners that we might need additional human resource personnel from overseas, particularly our neighbour countries such as Australia and New Zealand.
So there's a big push to get people vaccinated, with the rollout now starting to focus on regional and remote parts of the country.
We really need to get the vaccination coverage rate into the 80s and especially into the 90s before we can feel a bit safer and said maybe Vanuatu is now, you know, not only, you know, COVID-free but COVID-safe.
Dr. Regina Skevens says it's important the Pacific countries do weigh up the health risks when it comes to reopening their borders. It's a lesson French Polynesia learnt the hard way when it started accepting visitors around the middle of last year. When COVID-19 cases started to rise dramatically, the country was forced into a lockdown a second time.
Unfortunately, and not surprisingly, COVID has spread through French Polynesia and it's had a really heavy toll. So it is really important that countries assess those risks, and that's what I believe they're doing, and why a lot of other countries in the Pacific have taken a bit longer to want to open their borders.
While waiting a little longer to reopen may come at a cost to Pacific economies, when they eventually do welcome tourists back, Dr. Skevens says there'll be no shortage of demand. But for those who are looking to travel to the Pacific, she has a word of advice.
So I'd say if you're going to travel, enjoy it. Be generous with your hosts. Also be patient, because some of those businesses might be a little understaffed because a lot of their staff had to go and find other ways of making a living during this long 18 or more months without tourism. It's going to be really important for tourists to travel in a way that is generous and kind and considerate of their hosts, as well as enjoying that time lying on a beach and swimming in beautiful oceans.
Dr. Regina Skevens ending Marion Farr's report there with additional production from Dan McGarry. And I'd love to know what you think about how your country is handling the tourism reopening. If you're not in Fiji, if you're in another country that is taking a more cautious approach, do you wish that they were opening up like Fiji, or are you on board with how the government is handling things? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Just head to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page to get in touch. Australian Stephanie Wheeler arrived in Solomon Islands back in 2019. And when she got there, she never thought she'd end up meeting the love of her life. But that's until Tommy Essau came along. They only had a few short months together before the coronavirus pandemic shut down international borders. And then the couple were torn apart. But now, after 551 days of separation, they've been reunited.
We've just had our 2-year anniversary, so we met in September 2019 over here in Solomon Islands. So I was here for work, doing some malaria research work in quite a remote part of Solomon Islands. That's where he happens to be from. And he was actually the first person that I ever met in Solomon's right at the airport, which was really cool. I was coming over with friends who've known him for about 10 years. He just has the most incredible smile, and yeah, we just really connected. And so I was there for a couple of weeks doing this malaria work, and we just got to know each other then. I think we just connected, I don't know, when you know, I know that's so corny, and I never used to really believe people that said that, but we just clicked instantly, and it was just really easy and fun. And I don't think we ever would have imagined at the time that it would end up this, but we decided to give it a crack anyway.
Amongst the lush green palm trees shading white sandy beaches, Tommy and Stephanie fell in love. When Stephanie had to return home to Newcastle in Australia, they committed to a long distance relationship where they talked to each other every day.
So we were like messaging and video chatting on Messenger and stuff. Yeah, I think it was just that feeling of when something happens, just wanting to talk to him about it and vice versa, and just enjoying getting to know someone in that way.
At Christmas time, Tommy flew to Australia and spent the holidays with her family, and then she went back to Solomon Islands with him. But in March 2020, the coronavirus pandemic hit. Australia shut down its borders, and Stephanie got on the last plane out of the Sols.
So, like early January, my colleagues and I were saying, is this the big one? So my particular area is working in pandemic preparedness work. So I wasn't shocked that this was so big and protracted as a public health event. But in terms of the response and restrictions level, I never could have foreseen that it would be like this.
Midway through 2020, Stephanie and Tommy realized that the pandemic wouldn't be ending anytime soon. So started to apply for exemptions so that Tommy could enter Australia on the grounds of immediate family member and compassionate and compelling reasons. Their application was denied. So they tried again, and then denied. All up, Stephanie says they were rejected 16 times.
When the borders closed, of course, as an epidemiologist, I appreciate and understand the rationale. It literally saved people's lives, and I appreciate that. But the ongoing, it was just the endlessness of it that was really difficult. So we would apply, and applications for most people, I think ours went up to about 100 pages. They want to know that you have joint bank accounts, that you have a joint lease, that you have plans for the future. They want receipts of things that you've bought together. They want photo, like screenshots of messages that you've sent to each other. They want call logs to show that you talk to each other every day. And what the automated rejection email from ABF, from memory, it is something like, allowing this person entry does not outweigh the risk to the Australian community. And so this was something that I found very, very difficult, because in our situation, he is coming from a country that still to this day in October 2021 has never had COVID community transmission and was still never going to be allowed to come in. It was awful. It was really, really horrible. You feel like you're bearing your entire soul to a robot, or, you know, someone on the end of the ABF email who gets to look at all of the most intimate details of our relationship and then goes, nah.
The process took a toll on their mental health, so she turned to her local MP, Sharon Clayton, for support.
She took our case to Parliament and represented us there, which was just really wonderful, because it really feels like you're just nothing. You're just a pawn in the game. And for those of us who've been separated from family and loved ones, whoever that is, it feels like we've sacrificed a lot for the last year and a half to keep everybody safe. You know, having Sharon's support was really wonderful. When she gave her statement in Parliament, it was full of hears and all this and stuff across the room, but ABF, that doesn't mean anything.
After trying what seemed like every avenue to get Tommy into Australia so they could continue their lives, they decided instead for Stephanie to move to Solomon Islands.
We are so lucky. Like, we are, and I never would have thought that a year ago, but we really are lucky ones in that I have such a niche work role that I was able to actually get into the Solomons. I'm supporting the government here in implementing an epidemiology training program. It's a very, very lengthy, complex process to get in. Because of my role, I was able to. And so we decided that we would take a break from doing the exemptions into Australia because it was not going to work in our favor. So we started in January to just focus on getting me here. So that process started in March, and I arrived here at the beginning of September.
When Stephanie eventually arrived in the country, she had to do 3 weeks of quarantine. But she says it was all worth the wait.
Yeah, 21 days later, we finally got to see each other again. People kept asking, like, are we nervous? And I was like, no, I'm not nervous. I couldn't even imagine how it would feel. And people had kept trying to tell me along the way, oh, you should plan what you're going to do when you get together and you should try to visualize this. And I just couldn't. It just felt just painful, I think, to try to hope and plan for things and then it would just constantly get dashed. So I hadn't even really thought anything. And then we saw each other and it was just like I could breathe. Like it was just like a full body sigh, and we just stood there holding each other. And I think I still feel like that. Like it still feels like my body is just coming down from this immense long adrenaline push. Then we moved into our home and it's just been so easy and comfortable and like people kept saying to me, oh, it'll be like no time, like you'll kind of forget about it. That will never happen. It's become such a core part of our story. And, you know, for us, I really don't want to become toxic positivity about this, because there's very little that's positive. I think he and I worked exceptionally hard to not just keep our relationship going, but to really strengthen our relationship and to make it really solid. So I'm glad that we made the choice to do that. But yeah, no, it's been just so lovely to be back together again and just to do the normal stuff. Like, all we want to do is go to the market and have brunch on the weekend. And, you know, we come and sit out here in the morning and have our coffee looking at the view. And, you know, we go for a walk, went to the beach, just normal life stuff that just makes life enjoyable and lovely to share with someone. It's been so nice.
Australian epidemiologist Stephanie Wheeler talking there about reuniting with her partner Tommy Essau in Solomon Islands. Such a beautiful love story coming out of something that's really tough. A lot of people going through being separated from family and friends and loved ones because of border shutdowns. But theirs has happily had a happy ending. And Pacific Beat has reached out to Australia's Department of Home Affairs for comment on this story, but has not yet received a response. Time to find out what's making news and headlines across the region this morning. And I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Jordan.
Richard, let's start with news from New Caledonia. Police reinforcements have been flown in well ahead of the next independence referendum, which is scheduled for December 12th.
Yeah, we're told a contingent of 250 are all fully vaccinated. They've been welcomed into the French territory by the High Commissioner Patrice Faure and General Jean-Marc Decoux, who is in charge of security for the whole referendum process. And there will be more police arriving from France in the weeks ahead, with Radio New Zealand quoting the French Overseas Minister Sébastien Lecornu as saying 2,000 officers will be brought in total, because in a great democracy, there can be no feeling of insecurity. Now, there is already, it has to be said, some tension in New Caledonia ahead of the December vote, with pro-independence leaders calling for it to be deferred because of concerns over the impact of the pandemic on the Kanak population. And back in 2018, after the referendum that year, there was rioting south of Noumea, the capital, of course, which forced the closure of the main road for a couple of days. Now, the scheduled December poll is meant, of course, to be the third and final vote on the independence question, but I think there's still an element of doubt as to exactly how long this process may continue.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting, I guess, how people feel about having those reinforcements flown in as well, people on the ground and the Kanak population as well, about how they feel. So something that we'll have to keep an eye on here at Pacific Beat. But let's head over now to Papua New Guinea. Vaccination rates there are at rock bottom at the moment, and the COVID-19 crisis in the country is escalating. But nevertheless, Air New Guinea is making preparations to resume flights to Sydney next month.
Yeah, Sydney, of course, preparing to reopen its borders to international travellers, and Air New Guinea has already opened sales for a weekly flight from Port Moresby. It'll be on Mondays, beginning on November the 1st, and there may be more flights depending on demand. But it has to be said, the number of Papua New Guineans who will be on those flights is likely to be very limited, with the airline saying that at first they will be open to Australian citizens, permanent residents and special visa holders, with business travellers and tourists to be added at a later date. Now, whoever boards one of these flights will have to be fully vaccinated, of course, and complete a negative PCR test at check-in. The focus does seem to be very clearly on non-PNG passengers making the trip, but the door is not shut to locals who may want to fly to Sydney for work, school or leisure, for example. But the key, of course, will be vaccination. As Air New Guinea puts it, quote, "We recommend you get vaccinated now to avoid disappointment," which is one of the more unusual airline slogans I've heard in recent times. But recent history tells us that barely 1 in 100 Papua New Guineans are responding to that kind of advice at the moment. So I just wonder how many will travel. I suppose the question is how many would want to travel. But if they're going to travel, they are going to have to get vaccinated. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and I guess perhaps travel might be a bit of an incentive for some people. You know, if you want to travel anywhere in the world, really, you're going to have to be vaccinated. So
I think certainly for us in large parts in Australia, just to be able to go sort of, you know, down the road would be quite a good start, wouldn't
yes.
it? So.
We will see. Let's go over to sports news now. Moana Pacifica are adding another three players to their roster ahead of their debut Super Rugby Pacific season next year.
Yeah, Moana are following the Fijian Honduran, what you might say, drip-feeding fans with news of their recruits, although we understand the Auckland-based franchise actually has 30 players signed and sealed, so I guess we'll know all the names eventually. The latest trio to find themselves in the spotlight, all part of the Manu Samoa squad that secured their place in the 2023 World Cup with victory over Tonga about 3 months ago now. The players in question are Nerea Fomai, Tomasi Alosio and Henry Taifu. Fomai has featured for Samoa on the World 7 circuit, as has Alosio, who is among the team's top 15 all-time points scorers. 391 he scored for the Manu Samoa Sevens. Taifu first played for the Manu 15 in 2017. He has 10 caps to date. He also has Super Rugby experience with both the Queensland Reds and the Western Force. He's made 27 Super Rugby appearances in total, so he clearly will be a valuable asset. So that makes seven names made public so far on Moana's list, and there will, of course, be more to follow in the days ahead. And they do have a Facebook page, and they sort of give you little warnings and say there's a signing on the way, and it's all great fun. The Fijian and Drura have been doing it as well, so there's going to be a long, slow build-up for when these two teams actually play next season. But they've had to wait so long, so why not enjoy it?
And keeping fans on their toes.
Oh, yeah. I think the fans are kind of loving it, actually. And I mean, every time there's a signing made, there's a little mini debate about whether, you know, how good he is and how he fits into the team and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's a good way of building up momentum amongst the fan base as well, I think.
And that's building up to February 2022?
Yes.
Wonderful.
That will be it. And the game I'm looking forward to is when the two teams meet.
Eventually.
Finally. It'll be the first Battle of the Pacific. It'll be huge.
That'll be amazing. Yeah. Oh, well, can't wait for that. But yes, if you're a fan, Moana Pacifica, or even the Fijian Endura, just head over to their Facebook pages to get the drip feed of what's happening. But Richard Hewitt, thanks so much for joining me.
No worries, Jordan.
It is time now for a weather update across the region, and people are going to need to have their umbrellas out today because it is mostly rainy for pretty much all capital cities across the region today. Starting off in PNG's capital, Port Moresby, this morning it's going to be sunny at first, but rain is going to develop in the early afternoon and will carry through most of the day, and a top of 32 degrees is predicted. Rain also in Suva today. There will be showers throughout the entire day and they'll be reaching a top of 28 degrees. There's also going to be a top of 28 degrees in Port Vila and showers this morning that will carry into the afternoon. Much the same in Honiara, tops of 32 degrees, a sunny morning that will become increasingly cloudy in the afternoon and then a chance of rain in the evening. Showers in Apia as well with a top of 31 degrees. And in Nuku'alofa, you guessed it, there's a few showers expected and a top of 27 degrees.
This is a public health message about the COVID-19 situation in the Pacific region.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mengu Kendino, an emergency physician in Port Moresby. In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Doctors, nurses, and health workers have the most accurate information about COVID-19. Health workers can advise you on how to keep yourself and your community safe and what to do if you feel unwell. Always check the source of information you read or watch on COVID-19. Don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure that it's from a trusted source. Being well informed will help protect our community from coronavirus.
This is a public health message about the COVID-19 situation in the Pacific region.
Now, while the world's attention remains on COVID-19, the Pacific community has joined forces with the James Cook University in Brisbane to tackle the scourge of mosquito-borne disease that continues to blight the region. While a malaria vaccine may have been endorsed by the World Health Organization, the idea of eliminating the disease is still a long way off, demonstrated, of course, by 96 outbreaks in the Pacific between January 2012 and May 2021. Add to that 12 outbreaks of the Zika virus and 15 of chikungunya, and the scale of the mosquito problem that remains is all too apparent. So now comes the project known as PAC-MOSSIE, co-funded by Australia's Foreign Affairs Department and the French Development Agency, and one that will focus on, amongst other things, training, surveillance and response plans. And to tell me more about this, I'm joined now by Dr. Salanieta Saketa, SPC's senior epidemiologist. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Jordan.
Salanieta, as things stand, where are the holes? How is the Pacific failing to get to grips with mosquito-borne diseases?
The Pacific has made a lot of stride in epidemiological surveillance and in other ways of controlling vector-borne disease or mosquito-borne disease. But one of the things that's quite weak is actually controlling the vector, which is the mosquito. And many countries in the region, with the exception of a few, have established or not established mosquito control programs, and mainly due to lack of capacity, human resources and other resources, particularly training, to equip them with the right skills and knowledge to be able to control these vectors.
And so how exactly is that PAC-MOSSIE project going to help?
The PAC-MOSSIE project is a new project which comprises of a consortium of 12 international institutions, including James Cook University and the Pacific Community. Of course, the consortium is led by WHO and the James Cook University, and SPC is one of those 12 international partners. And, of course, the partnership is with all the Pacific Island countries in the region. And so PAC-MOSSIE is goal is really to strengthen vector surveillance and control in the region. And one of the ways in which you will do that is to raise capacity through training, and so to be able also to build up collaboration or regional networks that will help in sharing of best practices that can help countries to build up their vector control and vector surveillance programs.
And this surveillance and training up that the PAC-MOSSIE project is going to do, in practice, how is that going to take control, I guess, as you say, of the vectors, which are the mosquitoes?
Okay. One of the things that PAC-MOSSIE is going to do, first of all, is to do a needs assessment or needs analysis from countries, and which we are doing right now. And working with countries to identify what the actual needs are on the ground in terms of how they can battle, mosquitoes and the vectors. And so working on that evidence, we're then able to adapt our training accordingly. And our training is on entomology, is an eight module training, which we are on developing right now, and basically was intended initially as a face-to-face training, but now because of the pandemic and the closure of borders, we are also going into development of online training modules, which so countries can have both face-to-face and online trainings. And as we know, that with mosquito control, there are some aspects of it, particularly in the training, that require face-to-face, for example, identification of mosquitoes. So you really have to catch the mosquitoes and identify them. So that's the whole work, the whole idea of having this training is that countries will have the capacity to do, after their training, to be able to do surveys, mosquito surveys, so they're able to identify what are the key vectors in their neighborhoods and in the community, and so be able to also then plan control activities accordingly to target those vectors.
My guest this morning is Dr. Salanieta Saketa, SPC's senior epidemiologist, chatting with me right now about a new project called PAC-MOSSI that's aiming to train up and bulk up surveillance of helping countries bring about getting vectors or mosquitoes, especially that carry malaria, under control. Dr. Salanieta, with this new malaria vaccine that is in play, it's been endorsed by the WHO, is that going to impact on the overall success of this PAC-MOSSI project?
Oh, definitely. You know, it's a welcome thing to have a vaccine for malaria, as everyone's been waiting for that for a long time. But at the same time, we still need to control the vectors or the mosquito that transmit malaria. Although our work, particularly for SPC, has been really more focused around the Aedes mosquitoes, which transmit dengue, Zika, and chikungunya. But we know that three countries in the region still struggle with the burden of malaria. And, of course, we still need to target those vectors that transmit malaria, the anopheles mosquitoes. So, you know, having a vaccine would definitely, you know, prevent disease manifestation in people that are infected with or exposed to malaria, but at the same time, we still need to control the vector. So, you know, PAC-MOSSI just kind of just complements and strengthens our control efforts towards malaria.
And how much is this PAC-MOSSI project going to cost?
From the agency, from the French Development Fund, because that's much of the funding that we receive at the Pacific Community to support vector surveillance and control in the countries. We are looking at around, you know, over 1 million euro towards vector control activities. And one of the activities that we also, apart from you know, the consortium and the partnership we have in the PAC-MOSSI project and its activities, one of the things also that we've helped support is you know, development of a manual which was launched early this year, which is the manual on surveillance and control of Aedes vectors in the Pacific. So we hope that that manual will also serve as a reference during the training when the training start. And also with the DFAT funding, it's I believe it's over. I don't exactly have the figure, but it's a bit of money that's provided through the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade that also supports the PAC-MOSSI project.
And when is this project being rolled out?
It's currently being rolled out right now, actually. And so what we are doing at this stage is doing the needs assessment, as I mentioned, and also in the process of developing the 8 modules for the entomology curriculum. And so from the 8 modules, 3 modules are being supported by SPC through the French Development Fund, as alluded to, and the rest through the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade.
Well, Dr. Salanieta Saketa, thank you so much for joining me here on Pacific Beat and bringing me that update on the PAC-MOSSI project rolling out right now around the Pacific region. It's been great to have you on.
Thank you, Jordan.
That was SPC's senior epidemiologist, Dr. Salanieta Saketa, speaking with me there. Hey, hope you're having a great start to your Tuesday morning. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And because it is a Tuesday, it's time for Talanoa Tuesday. And on this occasion, I'm checking in with the LGBTQI plus community in the Pacific to ask what work still needs to be done to make sure that they're safe. Just a week ago, the man who killed human rights activist Polikalepo Polikefu in Tonga was jailed for life. And since the killing in April, people from across the Pacific and beyond have paid tribute to Polly's advocacy and activism in the LGBTIQ plus community in Tonga and across the region. But where to from here? And what would the LGBTIQ plus community like to see addressed and changed? Joining me this morning to discuss this is Ken Moala, the co-chair of the Oceania section of the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Talofa lava.
Talofa. And joining Ken is the executive director of the Tonga Ladies Association, Joey Jolene Mataeli. Good morning, Joey.
Good morning and good day to you.
Lovely to have you on the show. Hey, Joey, I wanted to start with you. What was your reaction to the news of the sentence for Polly Kefu's accused killer?
To be very honest, we're overwhelmed and we're just glad that justice has been done. I think it's more the Tongan person culture and just the way we were raised. You know, we forgive and forget. We do forgive. But the truth is we will never forget what happened to Polly, you know, and it'll be in our minds and our hearts for the rest of our lives. But I think that's just the overall feeling of what happened is that, you know, we're just glad that the justice has been done for Polly.
And speaking of justice for Polly, Ken, your organisation was calling for justice. Do you believe that that's been achieved?
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead, Ken. Yeah. What were you saying?
Well, look, I'm in 2 minds about this. I do believe that we need to show a bit of humanity here. Although we as activists and human rights defenders, seek to have justice, but we need to also show compassion. And I think this brings up the whole fact that, Polly was very much missed and his advocacy work is very much admired. But considering the legalities of it, I do believe justice has been served. You know, they could have gone the other route and asked for the death penalty. But, you know, I think Tonga's Lord Chief Justice showed a lot of compassion and in giving the verdict for a life sentence. So, it's a great relief to all of us. And I assume that for the families in Tonga, it is a relief for them as well.
And Joey, you're on the ground in Tonga. When it happened, many in the LGBTIQ plus community were saying that they feel really unsafe since this has all happened. Have you seen anything change in that regard?
Well, what we've seen is this, people a bit more compassionate and, because of what happened. Because every single time we talk about this issue, they think that nothing like this happened, that we're just being naive and all that, And when this happened to Polly, it really showed the true problems that we've been trying to deal with, And especially especially when it comes to bullying in schools and all that. That has been happening for years, And so what we've seen is people have changed their mentality, their minds of, those that have been marginalizing our community have, changed their attitude and they've come to support. At the same time, we see like what Ken has mentioned, we need to be more compassionate ourselves. We need to be more humanitarian, at the end of the day, you're practically related to everyone, but this case is no excuse for anybody to, you know, to actually pass it to the side, you know, pass it on to the side and put it aside and thinking that it's done, justice done, then we don't, you know, we're glad that everything's done and then we can leave it, you know, and then move on with our lives. You know, it's reminding us that there's still something that we need to do, you know, and I think that's pretty much.
Yeah, and Ken, being the co-chair of the Oceania section of the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association, obviously Joey there talking about on the ground exactly the ripples that have been felt in Tonga since the death of Polly Kefu. Across the wider region, though, are you seeing any change coming out of this that has happened within the wider LGBTQI plus community and how communities are responding to them?
No, there's a change is happening, but it's very slow. It needs to be pushing it along a bit because in the Pacific region alone, you know, there's still seven countries that still criminalize homosexuality. We have the Cook Islands, Kiribati, Papua New Guinea, Samoa, Solomons, and Tuvalu, and even Tonga. So really this needs to be approached from on a government level. You know, I think we need to really lobby the governments in the Pacific to repeal most of these archaic laws that were brought in by the during colonization. And I think it's important that we keep on lobbying our governments through the Pacific Forum and other regional agencies. And you know that also the United Nations actually stated that we must, you know, there was a declaration. You know, sometimes they make these statements, but there's no follow through. They want to acknowledge the need to protect human rights defenders. So in saying that, we need to carry that through using that mandate to approach our governments to say that we need protection under the current laws. Mm-hmm.
And Joey, you know, you're saying before that in Tonga specifically that there still needs to be that push to move forward. What exactly do you want to see happening in Tonga to continue that momentum and in that change and that shift?
Well, at the moment, we're actually trying to change to go into law reform, but you know, there's certain laws here, the colonial era laws, is still in place. And that's what we're trying to change, and to, you know, and we've got a few of the recommendations that we have put together to lobby for change, and that is for next year. Well, we were supposed to do it this year, but because of the problems, you know, that we're going through with the illicit drugs, and His Majesty has pushed for this to be to start this year. So every agenda that is out there, any bill that is supposed to go into, any other bill that's supposed to go into Parliament, has been pushed for next year. So we're looking at least April next year or May when Parliament starts. That will push this change for next year in probably May or June. Mm. So, you know, and working together with the Ministry of Justice, with the Crown Law, and also with the civil society networks, I'm sure we'll be able to change a few things.
Well, it's great to hear that hope. And thank you both of you for coming on the show. We are coming up to the top of the clock at the moment, but it's been great to have you both on to discuss this. And that flow and effect of obviously a tragedy with the death of Polly Kefu, but it sounds like hopefully change is happening. That was Executive Director of the Tongan Ladies Association, Joey Jolene Mataeli, and Ken Moala from the Oceania section of the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual and Trans Association speaking to me there. That's all here on Pacific Beat this morning. My name is Jordan Fennell. Thank you so much for your company.